Welcome to Reading Deadly Troubadours, the weekly podcast where I, Brent Thomas, read my novel, Deadly Troubadours. Let's begin, shall we? Part 3 of Chapter 3. Trist. The quest begins. The meet was so named because it had no fixed location. A fixed location was simple for all to find, and so unworthy for an order that liked to crow about its own intelligence. Not to mention, it would make far too tempting a target for the new tireless city guard. And so the location of the meet shifted randomly at the whims of the order masters to one of dozens of potential locations. The only constants were the presence of alcohol and the Stone Prince. The Stone Prince was exactly what it sounded like, a statue of a man in fine garb with a small crown upon his head. It was also one of the ugliest statues ever seen. The eyes drooped, the mouth was fixed into a crooked expression somewhere between a grimace and a grin, the nostrils flared to an unearthly width, and the sculpted man was either lurching forward or suffered from a rather extreme hunch in his spine. Who the Stone Prince was and where he was from was shrouded in mystery and legend, two things that the Order of Free Thinkers loved to expand upon simply to make the telling better. Two popular legends existed. One held that once upon a time, a prince of the realm came to visit the former town of Angelview. The heads of Angelview wished to make the most of such a rare visit by flattering the prince with an exquisite gift. An exact, or more accurately put, idealized likeness in rare star stone. The finest of sculptors were commissioned and set to work on the statue. Their carvings went on night and day for 2 moons and produced a thing of unearthly beauty. The day came when the prince visited Angelview. He was feasted and fawned upon. His every movement proclaimed his art. Finally, the shrouded statue was wheeled in. An elegant speech was given at how this statue would show the love and true feelings the entire city held for the prince. The shroud was lifted, revealing the ill-matching features, roughly chopped into the commonest of stone. A silence filled the court. The prince stood, declared that the statue should remain where it stood until he returned, and he promptly quit the court and the entire city. He returned 1 month later, with an army so mighty that it managed to wipe the city off this plane of existence, leaving only the statue intact as a warning to those who would insult him. It is, of course, left up to the listener to assume that the Order of the Free Thinkers was behind the statue's replacement. It is also never clarified if this is a boastful story or one of caution, and that is the true story of the Stone Prince. Unless, of course, the other true story is being told. That tale holds that once upon a time there was a kind prince who was loved across the land for his mercy and kindness towards the peasants and commoners. The only place where he was not loved was, sadly, in his own keep. His counselors and nobles felt he was squandering the royal fortune by using it to ensure that all children, no matter how low born, went to bed with a full belly. They insisted that money be spent on new tapestries and fine armors and rich foods for their merriments and tournaments. These noble counselors conspired together to make an unction so mortal that it would put an end to the generous prince. The next day, when the prince broke his fast, he drank his plain water from his simple wooden cup and found it poisoned. The search for a cure went out, but none was found. In the end, the only option seemed to be submitting to the poison, when a little man offered up a most unusual option. The little man had in his possession milk from a manticore, which would turn any who drank it to pure stone. The little man also claimed to have a potion that could reverse the effects of the milk. If he could return the prince to stone, it would give him time to work out an antidote to the poison ravaging the prince's body. The prince agreed and drank the milk. His fair appearance, already twisted from the effects of the poison, was further racked in agony by the power of the milk, resulting in the deformed statue. When the scheming nobles heard what had happened, they quickly put the little man to death, killing off his secret knowledge as well. They also planned to smash the Stone Prince, ensuring that he would never live again. But before they could act, it was stolen away. This story was designed to impart the message that the Order of Free Thinkers was a noble order whose ultimate goal was to find a cure for the deadly poison and to find the lost secret of reversing the Manticore's curse. There was a third story, seldom told and little regarded, that the statue was stolen by Fat Devlin and Skinny Rob during an evening of pure drinking. They spotted the statue at the end of a little cul-de-sac, declared it the ugliest likeness of a man ever carved into stone, and decided they must have it. Being members, they brought it to the next meet, and it was quickly adopted as honorary member and patron of the Order of Free Thinkers. Regardless of its unknown origins, or perhaps because of them, the Stone Prince was held in high regard by the Order of Free Thinkers. Any boast made to the prince must be a true one, and any vow made to it must be fulfilled. Breaking a vow to the prince would result in a massive loss of face by the offending party, and possible penalties including fines or even banishment from the order. Offerings of food and coin were often left at its feet to ask for its favor in upcoming adventures, or even simply as a show of respect. In an order of self-proclaimed rogues, pranksters, and ne'er-do-wells, it was perhaps the only thing that the order made truly sacred. So, when the four members of the Deadly Troubadours arrived at the meet, it was only natural that their first visit was to approach the Stone Prince and pay their respects. Alec harshly strummed a dissonant chord, causing the room to fall silent, and looked towards the prince. Friends, rogues, and others, his voice swept over the crowd, we invite you all to bear witness to what we have brought to honor our patron. The gifts had been decided beforehand, and each member had their part to play. The Stone Prince must hunger, called out Kestra. To fill his stomach, I offer this cheese, made from the milk of snow-white goats and threaded with fresh spring basil. It is common fare, but it is fine enough to nourish our own loyal city guard. Murmurs went through the crowd at the reference as Kestra placed the small hunk of cheese at the Stone Prince's feet. Like all of us, the Stone Prince's throat must on occasion grow parched. Talbert stepped forward and lifted his offering high in the air as Alexander kept time on his mandolin. Made from the watery grapes of the Race Valley, I offer up this wine. What it lacks in majesty, it makes up in its abundance, and rumor tells us that this very blend is what can be found on the feast table of our own noble city guard. The murmurs grew louder, and a few curses flew through the air. With a full belly and a moist throat, said Demetrius, as it came to be his turn to make the offering, what more could our prince wish for? In his hands was the simple leather bag, holding the true treasure they wished to offer. As for me, all I wish for, more than food and drink, is the knowledge that I am safe. The crowd was getting more vocal in its disdain. Safety was all fine and good, but it was bad form to publicly prefer safety over adventure. What can offer more safety than our own fine city guard? The curses were loud and came quick. The only thing preventing Tate from being pelted with scraps of half-eaten food was his close proximity to the statue. While I cannot offer up one of those magnificent soldiers, I can only hope that our patron will be content with this. With the flourish, he pulled the helmet from its bag and lifted it high into the air. The sight of the bright crimson helm quieted the hall. The orange reflections of the torchlight held the audience in trance. All eyes followed it as Demetrius slowly moved it down and placed it at the stone feet of their patron. As if a great dam had burst open, so did the sudden cheering sweep over the four. The members of the crowd sitting closest to the prince surged forward, and the small guild was besieged with embraces, congratulatory arm slaps, and handshakes. Full drinks were pressed into empty hands again and again. Demetrius lost track of the amount of times the tale was requested of him, and his guildmates lost track of the different variations he offered. Eventually, the story had increased to the four of them being cornered by a full legion of scarlets, but rather than submit to the odds, the deadly troubadours had given the 500 guards the opportunity to escape unscathed should they be willing to offer up their helms. When the guards scoffed and refused, battle was joined. The 500th and last of the now bruised and battered guard cravenly offered up his helmet in order to keep from receiving the beating his brothers had so stoically borne. As the hours swept by, wine and ale gave over to harder spirits. Other members of the deadly troubadours found themselves giving in to the storytelling urges and offered up reality-distorting tales of their epic victory. The tale repeated again and again with the fighting spirit of the Scarlets waning and then waxing again with each fresh telling. To heighten the fighting prowess of the troubadours, the guards could be insulted by comparing them to poultry, snails, or even slow-growing species of moss, only for the next retelling to proclaim the Scarlets as earthbound guards of combat, akin to bears. No! Lions! No! Dragons! Yes! Slurred Tate at those around him, conscious enough to listen. That is exactly what they are. Dragons. Big, fuck-off dragons, but with shining red helms. Heads! He lurched forward and back as he spoke, splashing his drink as he wildly gestured. Talbot took the drink from him and drank deeply, ending it. But never let it be said that the deadly troubadours feared something as common as dragons, Talbot proudly proclaimed. Why, it is fortunate that there are no dragons nearby. For their sake. And why is that? Cooed a blonde member of the shark gang. She seemed to be on equal footing of drunkenness with the others. Nor had it gone unnoticed that the more she drank, the more unlaced her bodice had become to combat the heat. She leaned towards Talbot, offering him a prime view of what many considered to be the best offerings the shark gang could conceivably offer to the Stone Prince. "Because we would raid its den and make off with its most prized possession," Kestra informed the buxom thief, and pulled her close, and coincidentally, away from Talbot. "And what would that be? Gold? Gems?" "A dragon's prized possession," asked Alec, who, although he was currently too drunk to stand, still plucked out notes with exceeding skill. "What they value above all else is their eggs. Everyone knows that as fact." "Then that is what we would do. We would steal a dragon's eggs as easily as we made away with this bit of metal," boasted Tate, tapping the helm he was now wearing. "Then do so," jeered a voice. "Alas, we would, but there are no dragons to be found in Trist," laughed Talbot. "I hear there's one on top of Coal Mountain, up north," offered up Alec, master of song. "Well, even so, there's no reason to believe she has eggs. Legend has that she does. She lost her mate, and her den is too cold with just her to warm it for the eggs to hatch. And she don't leave the eggs alone long enough to find a new mate. They're all far in the south, you see. So there's eggs and dragon alike on Coal Mountain." "Then fine. The deadly troubadours are so lacking in fear that we will travel to this Coal Mountain and remove a dragon egg," declared Tate. "So say you all?" asked Dothmar, the all-too-sober record-keeper. "So say we all," the four members chorused. Then it is so noted that before the Stone Prince, the Righteous Guild of the Deadly Troubadours did boast they would steal an egg from the Dragon of Coal Mountain. "May Swain, God of the Paths, watch over you on your quest." The silence hung heavy in the meet as the boast was made official. It was Talbot, most learned of the guild, who summed up the complex feeling of his guild mates. "Well, fuck me." And all Demetrius, instigator of this turn of events and drunkest of the troubadours, had to offer in reply was the sound of gentle snores as he slumped deeper into his chair. That's all for this week. Thank you for listening. Deadly Troubadours will soon be available as an ebook from most ebook retailers. If you want to hear more about me, Brent Thomas, you can visit my website at deadlytroubadour.com. You can also like me on Facebook by searching for the page Deadly Troubadours. This podcast is available at iTunes, so if you have a moment, please rate and review it. And while you're there, why not check out my other podcasts, such as Comics League International and the show I co-host, Living Japan. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at deadlytroubadour@gmail.com. Once again, thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in next week for the continuing adventures of The Deadly Troubadours.